In 2002, our next guest, Glenn Murcutt, won the very significant Pritzker Prize for Architecture. This is what the jury said about him. In an age obsessed with celebrity, the glitz of our starchitects, backed by large staffs and copious public relations support, dominate the headlines. As a total contrast, Murcutt is a one-person office on the other side of the world. Yet he has a waiting list of clients, so intent is he to give each project his personal best. He is an innovative architectural technician who is capable of turning his sensitivity to the environment and to locality into forthright, totally honest, non-showy works of art. Last month, Glenn Murcutt gave the last of this year's Utzon Lectures at the University of New South Wales. It took the form of an extended conversation with me, and here's an edited version of what we said.
Well, Glenn, given that you're a professor in this faculty, I can hardly say welcome to you, but...
Welcome to you.
Thank you. But it's a great pleasure to be talking to you, more particularly because I get the impression you don't really like talking about yourself. Is that true?
My wife would tell you that's not true. But in public, that's quite true. It's a fairly private thing that I like to maintain.
Now, you grew up, you were born in England, but you grew up in Papua New Guinea, and it's clear that you were taken with the vibrant landscape in which you grew up. Do you think this has affected your architectural career, or at least your relationship to landscape?
Yeah, I think this is a very important thing that some people pick up on and a lot don't. When you live in a region of the world where the nearest European is about 15 kilometres away, and you're living amongst the Kukukuka people, who are the cannibal people of Papua New Guinea, and we lost friends whilst we were there, and there's kunai grass that's 1.5 metres tall pretty well. And at about early morning, sunrise and sundown, the cookers would come out of their village and they'd be coming down to strike. And the indentured, as we had then, a terrible situation, people from different parts of Papua New Guinea would start to shake and you knew that something was going wrong. And you'd see in the snake in the kunai grass, as I said, at 1.5 metres, the kukukuka is 1.49 metres tall. So they were just below and they would come down. And so what that taught all of us in New Guinea was the power of observation, the power of smell, the power of actually looking and revealing was extremely important as one aspect. The other aspect is the way through which materials were delivered. And post was delivered, and Christmas presents were delivered. A gypsy moth, small plane, open cockpit, would fly over once a week, come down to around about 50 metres, and throw everything out of the plane. And it'd land in the kunai grass. We had to have red tail coming up in the grass so you could find where it was. And that was the way you found your mail and food parcels for Christmas and Christmas presents from Australia. This is very significant when you realise that I'm now at the age of going five, nearly six, and the war breaks out. We live on a scorched earth policy. Swimming pool's blown up, the water supply's blown up, the house is burnt down, and we all leave on the last boat out of Papua New Guinea to Australia. To arrive where a postman blows a whistle, where there is no danger of survival in the same way. But it gave the power of observation of the land to actually observe how water falls, to understand that every afternoon in Papua New Guinea at 2 o'clock, the clouds would build up, the thunder would come, huge rainfall, and then calm, and the water would flow everywhere. The climate down here is totally different. So all of a sudden, these differences are great and very sharp learning processes. And so that whole ability to observe, to be able to bring out and understand what is relevant and what is really appropriate in designing something.
Well, after that extraordinary description of your childhood, I hesitate to ask you whether you, because perhaps you've already given it, but whether you have a really significant early memory. But do you have more to tell us?
Or do you want this to go the whole night? Two questions asked. That'll be the first time, two questions. Well, yes, there are many things. The fact that I was raised by Minja, Asika, Wallen and Quack, they were four 16-year-olds, all Papua New Guineans, nationalist New Guineans, the most wonderful parents you could possibly have. They gave us 100% of time. And so coming to Australia, I didn't speak any English at all. So English is my second language. Pidgin English was my first language. So if you see a helicopter, you say, Impella, Impella, Mixmaster, belonging God. Now, Impella Mixmaster means this thing, this fellow, Mixmaster is the egg beater, belong him God. Now,
they really said that. I've always thought that was a myth.
Impella Mixmaster, yeah, belong him God. True, as they say, true. English was a very difficult language for me, I've got to say to you, in learning at school, and it was the bane of my life through the whole of high school years. But in New Guinea, my father would leave early morning and go down to the alluvial gold mine, and that was a big problem for me in later life, thinking about this gold mining that he pursued, and to realise the toxicity of all this and the destruction of the land as in gold mining. And so consequently, when my father came to Australia, he had made very good money, he bought many sites, but he protected them with his life. He wouldn't let anybody cut a tree down. And he had a loud hailer down at Clontarf. He'd yell out the loud hailer come bonfire night, just stop cutting down those so-and-so trees. And I get to school the next day, and the kids would say to me, there's a madman living over your way. Look out for him. Watch out. He's a madman. Well, the reality became he didn't destroy as much as I had anticipated. Alluvial gold, when you're using sluice gates and things like that, are far less destructive than big machinery. It was actually very low tech in many ways.
You just mentioned your father. You seem to have had a complex relationship with him, which was extremely important to you. I don't want to go into details, except to say that he made you join him in his joinery shop. He also taught you how to make bricks. Was this early exposure to raw materials important to you in your later architectural career?
Well, there was no alternative in my family. When you're told that you're going to be, every school holiday, you're, from the age of 11, you're going to be in the joinery shop. By the time I was 15, I was making box frame windows, I was making casement windows, I was making staircases in the factory. By the time I was 18, within the factory, I built racing sailing skiffs. By the time I was 18, I'd carried the bricks, I'd helped him make bricks up at Alma Street on a first concrete bricks after the war. I would have been 10. The industry of building was with me my whole childhood. It was absolutely rigorous. We'd get up at 5:30 in summer, do a half-mile swim at Clontarf, run back home. I'd have to clean the bathroom, half an hour music practice, breakfast, and walk to school 2 kilometres by 9:15. And after school, he would be there at 3:15, 3:30, down to Manly Baths, a mile swim, a couple of 100-metre dashes, breaking the minute, then back home, half an hour music practice, study, dinner, and you know, it was very difficult. The thing was, I towed the party line. Not everybody in my family towed the party line. I, being the eldest, was a bit more afraid. So there was this complex relationship, but it was a complex relationship with immense depth of love.
You graduated as an architect, having, while a student, worked with Neville Grusman, the Sydney architect, and in the early 60s, we find you touring Europe, all sorts of architecture, very different from the architecture you grew up with. What would you say were the major lessons here?
First of all, I go back to questions of the relationship of my father. He brought in journals from the United States, and I knew the work of Wright, of Korb, of Meese, of the Keck brothers, of Elliot Noyes. I knew all these people, the Weiss brothers, a huge number of people before I started university. And so that was extremely important to me in terms of knowing about architecture. And then working with people like Neville Grusman, every Saturday going on my motor scooter down to see the work of Peter Muller, Bill Lucas, Harry Seidler. These were absolutely critical things as a student. Now, I was working from 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 5 days a week, 4 days a week. Thursday was art at university here. Saturday morning was bricklaying, painting, plastering, carpentry, and surveying. And these were disciplines that the university required us to pursue, amongst other things. So I had a very good grounding in many ways in architecture before I started and during architecture. Going overseas, of course, is an important thing for everybody in this country. Because we're so far removed, ordinariness becomes the norm. It is a nation that is fairly visually illiterate. It is a nation that is pretty illiterate in architecture. And to break anything out of it is incredibly complex. But the real problem is that something that's so mediocre that can be here, to go a bit above it, you tend to think this is great stuff. But of course, you need to go away to really see the best of the best, which becomes the bar, that you've got to really try and understand and work to try and achieve not what they're doing, but understand the principles, understand how things work. Why did an architect make this decision to do it this way, not do it another way? Would I do it this way? How would I do it differently? Or is this really the appropriate way of thinking about it? So it was not about going away to see what people did and how I'd bring those things back. It was how to understand the principles underlying the best of the best. That's so important. That's why I travelled. And that's why most young architects travel. And I was away for 2.5 years, nearly 3 years, for this whole event.
And a lot of the architecture that seems to have impressed you in places like Yugoslavia and certainly Greece, I think it's what we'd probably call vernacular. Mm. I mean, it's not big-name architecture.
No. Yes, I spent altogether 6 months in the Greek islands, one of the most remarkable places. I mean, if you look at Rudofsky's book, Architecture Without Architects, you'll see a lot of it in that. And the incredible thing is that we have lost the art of building. We've lost the art of design as a culture, whereas these people had the art of design as a culture. You go to the Trulli region of Italy, you go to the Greek islands, and you start to understand what it's about. The first time I went to the Greek islands, I came back absolutely emotionally bowled over by the place. And I said, I've got to go back to understand this place. And you do understand it, so that when you see a street, cross street, and you see the walls coming down and vertically, now in section, a wall coming down and cut away at that point there, coming out at 450 above the ground and down, you get the four corners with a little triangle on each corner. And you say, what a wonderful thing to have done. It gets the wind turning around. It gets the view turning around. It's so wonderful. It tells you about the street's movement. And then you get four generally old men sitting on the corners, maybe a cup of coffee, and you say, isn't this just a marvellous thing? And then you start to analyse this and analyse, was this really the reason it was done? You go back and you start to look and really start to observe. And you look at donkeys, and you look at donkey's belly, and you look at a donkey loaded with sack, and you look at a donkey with a man on or a woman on, and you realise the donkey doesn't know beyond its own form. The donkey does not understand that. And so the form becomes the form of carrying something or carrying a human. So the cutout is for the human's head, comes down to a given point for where a sack is coming out or the legs on a human, and the cutout at the bottom is sitting on a donkey, your feet are above the seat. It is for an entirely different reason. And this is the whole point in observation. You must understand the underlying principles, not be bowled over by the romantic notion. The romantic notion can only get the juices going to start the questioning. And it's the questioning process of everything that has to be the underlying quest as architects.
We've got to get back to Australia soon, but another two questions about overseas countries. You're now on the jury of the very important Alvar Aalto Medal, and of course you've won it yourself. Is Aalto an important influence on you?
I'll tell you how that happened. I was working with a very good friend, close friend, Keith Cottier, and I said I was going back to the Greek islands for the fourth time, and he said, Glenn, you've done the Greek islands. You just got to go to Scandinavia. You've got to go to the Nordic region. You've got to go and see Aalto. Of anybody that should see Aalto, it is you. Now, again, the work that comes is not Aalto's work, but the principles of Aalto, of site relationship, of observation, of a way a window is done, that a window doesn't have to be a ventilator at the same time. A ventilator can be separate from the window. The window can frame a particular view. Windows don't have to be full glass walls. A whole lot of principles with Aalto. The use of materials. Look at Aalto's buildings today, how beautiful they still are, a timelessness. I regard Aalto's work as probably amongst the most timeless works that have been produced in the last 200 years. Timeless, timeless work. It was as modern then as it is today, as I believe it will be tomorrow. Look at the church at Vuksanesco, Imatra. Look at that incredible church. Look at the space. Look at the geometry. It is just an amazing work of architecture. I've spent days in this building, and I'll go back and spend many more days. Have a look at it. As Onni Siriani said to me after receiving the medal, he said, did you take photographs of Aalto's work when you were in Finland this time? I said, I did. This was in 1992. The first time was 1964. He said, have a look at the photographs you took in 1990, in the recent ones and the one in 1964, and look what you're looking at when you in the first time and look what you're looking at the second time. Do you know, I didn't even notice in the first time the type of ear that came out just before the altar. And the ear that comes out, which just holds the space. It just holds the space as defined as a particular space. It's not cutting it off. Whereas the church at Lahti, the space just folds down into it. Totally different idea. And I missed it the first time. There are a lot of these subtleties that are so beautiful. They're sort of kinky, they're eccentric, but they're real and they work because this guy was a real master.
More recently, you've been to Japan, where the architectural community saw a lot of connection between your work and Japanese architecture. But you say you're glad you didn't go there earlier because it might have overwhelmed you.
Yes. I wasn't ever going to go to Japan in my life because I had a great fear of Japan. I grew up in Sydney. I left New Guinea because of the Japanese coming to New Guinea. I grew up in Sydney. The submarine that was blown up in Sydney Harbour, I picked up in my canoe at the age of 9 and a half down in Clontarf, the Japanese hat from one of the sailors. I didn't know it was at the time. I just had and I lived through the war years. The Japanese were coming to Sydney. I was on the ferry where the Japanese submarine came in at the 11 o'clock ferry in the morning. I was petrified of Japan. And so I never was going. And then when I was invited to have an exhibition, I wrote and said, well, thank you very much, but no. But the Japanese, being very insistent and so different to the people I thought, they sent a team down and joined up with Mariam Gouche and Wendy Lewin and Catherine Lassen and Tom Hannigan and a whole group of people. And the Japanese were very smart. They put all these people together without my complete knowledge and then said, they're coming down to meet me. So I said, fine. They met me and they were so nice. I said, okay, well, if you're going to do all this work, that's fine. I'll do it. But to answer your question directly, it is to say that in visiting the Minka villages, they're the country villages, which include fishing houses and inland houses and snow architecture. The architecture of the Japanese, from the coastal to the highland, varied, using the same mat system, varied incredibly all the way through. But the ingenuity of details, like to have four windows vertically that come up in a track, and then there's a stacking box at the head, so you can bring them up and put them in the stack them in the head all the way through. And then if you only want privacy at the bottom, you just bring one down at the privacy at the bottom. If you want two levels, you can have it, or three levels. It is so fantastic. Unbelievably beautiful stuff. And the answer to your question is, my biggest concern was, had I gone to Japan instead of going to Europe, I think that I would have translated too literally the work, not to understand the principles as I understand them today. And going there today, it is very nice to see that the Japanese recognize a quality in the work that I've been producing that has a relationship to what they have been doing, that I wasn't influenced by Japan. I hadn't known anything much about Japanese architecture at all because of my fear.
We've talked about the influence on you of European architecture, of the work of Alvar Aalto, and also of your father. Mm. While we're talking about cross-generational influences, your son Nick Murcutt, who died tragically young this year, was a very distinguished architect. But he seemed to become an architect without any prompting from you. Is that true?
Absolutely the case. You know, I had received a travel grant in 1972, which took me away from the family for 4 months. And I found it very painful to be away from my children and family. I found it very painful for that period of time. And I got back and I said to the boys, I will not go overseas again until you come and I'm old enough to enjoy it with me. So we both went, the three of us went overseas when Nick was about 20. And he had matriculated, he had got into universities, he deferred, he decided he liked cooking. And so he'd work with Cos Psaltis and other people. Gay Bilson had made inquiries through me to see whether Nick would like to come down and join the Barara Waters Inn team. And I thought, well, here's a guy who wants to be really become a chef. Let's go to France and let's get him booked into something in France. We picked up a 2CV. We went south. My other son, Daniel, was very interested in photography. So the whole trip of a month and a half was going from Paris straight down on the 7th of November, straight south down to the Moroccan Sahara Desert. And the whole way through, we looked at things for light levels, we looked at photographic subject matter, we looked at art, we stayed in good hotels, we stayed in poor hotels, we ate good food, we ate terrible food, we visited great museums and not such great museums, we looked at how people dressed in relation to the clothes, we looked at the culture as we moved southwards. It was just a fantastic experience. And we got back to Paris, and I said goodbye to the boys, gave them a week in Saint Anton for skiing, and I went off to America. And then I came home. Nick was organized to go to a very good school in Paris, and I expected him to be there for 3 months. And I got home, and who's sitting at home but Nicholas? I said, what the hell are you doing here? He said, well, the enrolments for architecture closed yesterday. And so I got back in time. I said, what the hell are you talking about? And he said, I'm going to do architecture. I said, my God, I can't believe you. We've never discussed it. Anyway, there you are. And, you know, together with the beautiful Rachel, the daughter I never had, I've got to say that it has been the most painful 18 months of my life. I haven't worked for 14 of those 18 months, but I won't talk too much more about it. It's been a very tough time, very, very, very tough time. We had a wonderful relationship. People said to me, how did you structure this fantastic relationship? I said, look, when Nick and Rach got together, he rang me and he said, look, with Wendy and yourself as architects, Nick and I as architects, when we meet, can we not talk about architecture? I said, sure, Nick, sure, but I've got a that's your condition, I've got a condition as well. And he said, well, what is it? And you could hear his jaw drop. And I said, you must promise me, now you really must promise me, the moment you want to talk about architecture, you will. And that took 9 months, a gestation period. And he didn't stop talking. Even to 4 weeks before he died, he's talking about the design of a house with cupboards, just using cupboards, and then you're sling things between cupboards. 4 weeks before he died, catching a plane back to go to hospital from Kempsey, the Crescent Head. Amazing. A fantastic kid. A wonderful son. What a privilege it was I had him for 46 years. But our children, as I said, are only ever on loan. And that 46 years was a wonderful 46 years to have had him that long.
You say that you're not interested in Australian architecture, which is interesting given that most people would think of you as the most Australian of architects. What did you mean when you said you were not interested in it?
I am not interested in producing an Australian architecture, not Australian architecture, which is quite different.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah. I'm very interested in Australian architecture. Or architecture by Australians. I just am so excited when I see a good work being done. I will ring that person. As some of you will know, when I see the work done well, I will ring. And it's fantastic to see it. If you sat down to look at trying to design an Australian architecture, then all you'll end up with is a caricature. That's all you can possibly do. It can only come out of the ether. It can only come out of understanding the site, understanding the climatic conditions, understanding where the sun comes from, understanding the flora, the fauna, hydrology, geology, topography. You just go on. Then when you understand soil conditions and tree and flora conditions, you understand insects. When you understand insects, you understand animals and birds. They all are totally interrelated. You can't separate. But if you've got that in your head when you're designing, and remember, my first break after designing things around the suburbs and the city, after 10 years, was the house at Kempsey for the Short family. And that gave me the break to be able to start to read the land, to smell the land. I mean, the land you can smell. When the rain is coming, you can smell the rain coming. When the wind northeasters in the summer come across a lake and there are water lilies, the perfumes come into a building. These are really important elements in architecture. They're not about sitting down and designing some fancy work of architecture. It's about the architecture being an instrument of placemaking. So, in other words, One is, in a sense, composing things. One is wanting to bring in the smells, the perfumes, the sounds, rejecting the mosquitoes, having all these elements so that the building becomes the instrument to hear the rainfall. When the rain falls, to smell it coming off the roof, the warmth from the rain and the smell of the water. These are really significant parts of Australia. And that's why I take the students that I have out of their comfort zone, pardon me. But it's to take them out of this comfort zone because it exposes them and makes them frightened. And that's really important to make students and all of us frightened. As Jose Paderk said to me in 1973, I tell my students, first you must put into your work effort, second, love, and finally, in very Catholic Spanish, suffering. And the reality is, as he said to me, you know, he said, and he was 62 or 3 when I met him, with every new project, I am very nervous. That was the statement that released me completely. A fantastic statement. No architect had ever told me or even indicated they were slightly nervous about their design or what was ahead of them. I have always been totally anxious before a design starts. Excited, but anxious.
And I was interested in one of your observations, which was that if you were designing a building and if you wanted to know whether it fitted into the place for which you were designing it, you imagined it for another place, and if it worked in that other place, then obviously it wouldn't work in this place.
If those students in the room here have heard that, yes, we're doing a project in Lightning Ridge. Now, we got in the first part of the year, we actually got some projects that could have been on the beachfront, down in on Collaroy or somewhere like that. Not the ocean beach, but a couple were ocean beach pieces of architecture. And so I say, can this building be put into another climatic zone? That's another climatic zone I'm referring to, and for it to be read just as good in that zone. And if the answer is yes, you really question it, because it should not. When you've got temperatures at Lightning Ridge at 45, 46 during the daytime in summer, going down to 18 at night, and in winter going up to 17 or 18 in a day and going down to -5 at night, it's very different to a climatic zone when there's such a difference in diurnal temperature from season to season. It's just a totally different proposition. And so one has to understand climatic zones, and you're quite right, yes.
You mentioned that your half an hour, I think it was twice a day, in the morning and the afternoon, music practice.
Yeah.
When you were a kid. Do you still play?
No.
You played the piano, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, if you're going to play musical instrument, the dexterity required when you're into concerto work is so considerable that when your hands start to freeze up a bit because you're not practicing the same, the compromise is not enough. I hate compromise.
Well, some 18th century German, I can't remember whether it was Schiller or Goethe, described architecture as frozen music.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether you see a connection between architecture and music, given that they both involve complex relationships.
Mm. Yeah, you know, music has colour, it has rhythm, it can be contrapuntal in nature. There are all sorts of systems in music and structures of the 6-4-5-3 onto one, the dominant seventh onto one. All these structures in music, I realise in having had to learn music and theory, which I did for my matriculation, has contributed enormously without one knowing it. So it's a symbiosis sort of thing that takes place, that all of a sudden you start to realise that the rhythm in music, you can't get out of it, a rhythm in architecture. I love rhythm in architecture. I love modular systems. I love the way things go together and how you can take Bach with, say, for example, C, D, E, F, G, A sharp, B, and coming up after you get to the E, the C, D, E, F, and following up behind it. And they're getting this beautiful complex rhythm. And all of a sudden, the rhythm's moving through, and then you get a trill. And that trill, it becomes another element that gives it that richness. It is just fantastic. Now, architecture can do the same thing. You can have a rhythm all the way through, then all of a sudden you can have an order all the way through, but every now and again there might be a reason to push out through that. And these are the sort of things that may well be similar, but it's not a conscious thing that I would be doing. I'd say it's something that, having understood the mathematics of music, then there's the mathematics of architecture, which has that sort of relationship.
Glenn Merkert, it's been a privilege to talk to you. Thank you.
Glenn Merkert in conversation with me in the last of this year's Utzon Lectures.